Hey everybody, today's guest is my friend Sean Stone. Sean has done a million things on every important subject that I care about, from pollution to transhumanism to the rise of totalitarianism to censorship and on and on and on. He has directed the documentaries, among many, many, many other accomplishments, which I'm not going to read out his whole CV here because it's enormous, but he's directed the documentaries, A Century of War, Hollywood, D.C., and Metahuman with Deepak Chopra. He also produced the documentary, The Paradigm of Money, about Wall Street corruption and collusion with the U.S. government. His limited docu-series, Best Kept Secret, explores the dark side of the Western elite's manipulation and control of humanity. His short film, Singularity, is a dystopian warning about a plague that leads to a totalitarian surveillance state. So that was pretty prescient. Sean has hosted the reality show Conspiracy Theory with Jesse Ventura, the interview program Buzzsaw, formerly on Gaia TV, and the RT news show Watching the Hawks. And I think that's where I first met you. Of course, I've known your father, Oliver Stone, for many, many years, and you, the apple did not fall far from the tree. And I'm hoping to have him on here. I talked to him yesterday.
Yeah.
I'm hoping to have him down when he gets back into the country. Let's talk about RTTV, because I think both you and I are deeply concerned about the rise of the surveillance state and an ancillary to that, which is the use of mass propaganda. And really, the very worrying phenomena that we have a generation of young people in this country that does not seem to be equipped to defend themselves against propaganda assaults, and are very, very susceptible to manipulation, are very easy about compliance, are kind of the opposite of the college generation of the 60s, which was defiant, which was skeptical, which was non-compliant. And we have a generation of cancel culture, of people who appear to be, you know, easily retreating into authoritarian, the warm embrace of safe totalitarian systems and orderly totalitarian systems, which I think you and I grew up with a profound fear and cynicism and skepticism about, you know, the growth of those bodies. So let's begin by talking about the expulsion, essentially, of RT America, which is Russian TV, which is at some level a propaganda project by Putin. But at the same time, it was a place where you could go and really see narratives that challenge the official orthodoxies in the United States, which is critical in a democracy. My father and uncle believe that all speech should be uncensored, and that our ideas here in this country ought to welcome challenge. We ought to welcome debate. If we could not triumph in the marketplace of ideas, then we didn't deserve to defend those systems. And here we have this kind of unity, this propaganda monolith coming from CNN on the one hand and Fox News on the other, both of which are owned by BlackRock, which also controls all these military industrial.
Amazing, isn't it? It's really remarkable.
We're now going to get $13.5 billion, which we are going to give to Zelensky, and they're going to give back.
Right, right.
BlackRock, you know, right, which is barraging us with this propaganda wall.
It's not new, though.
Let's just hear your, because I just talked a lot more than I thought I was going to.
Well, it's such a big thing to unpack what you said. I mean, I remember seeing a study a couple of years ago, maybe 2020 it was, and they were surveying maybe it was before 2020, because obviously there was a shutdown, but they were surveying college students and there was this sort of unprecedented amount of people saying the First Amendment should not be total free speech. You know, it should not be totally free, that there should be some level of restriction on it, or, you know, censorship. And especially we've seen that grow when it comes to, I've seen studies showing that Democrats in particular are in favor of governments and or big corporations, big tech, basically, the Democrats tend to be more in favor of censorship, you know, against misinformation. It's remarkable.
Stunning.
Yes. Stunning. Yes. And as you mentioned, I mean, I came of age in the 90s, you know, late 80s, early 90s. I remember very well the propaganda of marching to war against Saddam in 1991. The babies that were being pulled out of, remember the story, the babies being pulled out of incubators in Kuwait. And all this was made up basically, you know, by our various PR companies. You know, it was a design. It was a design to march to war. There was not contextualization for, you know, Saddam basically being given the biological chemical weapons that ultimately were used. They were given obviously by us in Western Europe to fight the Iran. Obviously there was a lot of collusion between us and Saddam since the early days. In fact, he was arguably a CIA puppet at the beginning, and you know, certain aspects of his policies were, you know, how do you say, our government was blessing them, right, all the way through the Iran-Iraq war. And then of course the narrative shifted by the time of the Kuwait invasion. Again, a lot deeper than what they told you on television, a lot more issues involved, including slant drilling. You know, the Kuwaitis involved in slant drilling into Iraq, and Iraq basically having this huge debt that they owed the Arab world and the West for fighting this war, presumably they thought on behalf of the Arab world against Iran, and all of a sudden their allies, presumable allies, turned against them, and the Iraq was left in a very difficult position. And Saddam had this weaponry, this artillery that had been sold to him. And the Americans said, hey, we take no issue. Remember April Gillespie, the diplomat said, oh, we have no issue between, we take no side or take no issue with your issue with Kuwait, basically. And it's a tacit agreement, not, you know, that's, again, that's just one of many factors. So I just remember the propaganda sold to us.
We basically, Rumsfeld's direction, we basically green-lighted his invasion of Kuwait and then went to war with them over it.
Right, right.
I wanted to say one thing at the outset of this. Neither you nor I think that Vladimir Putin or Saddam Hussein are good guys.
Sure, that's nothing to do with that.
What I think both of us feel that we need to look at is this penchant of America to be the police person of the world, to go from emergency to emergency, crisis to crisis, war to war. We've been out of Afghanistan for what, 3 months? It's the longest war in our history. And now we're going back to war again. And a lot of this propaganda assault is very reminiscent of what happened with Saddam Hussein. And after that, all the, you know, New York Times, Washington Post, they all had to apologize for not looking skeptically at the runway to the war, this yellow journalism, and for taking part in it and getting us involved at what that point in history was regarded as the worst foreign policy blunder in American history. It cost us $3 trillion and, you know, killed more people and died in the World Trade Center attack, which Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with.
Yeah, I don't know that Iraq is worse than Vietnam. I think that's arguable. I think even arguably the First World War, I think, is actually our biggest, I would argue our biggest foreign policy was the First World War, because they were all empires. You know, at the end of the day, it wasn't like the German Empire was worse than the British Empire. The British Empire had a quarter of the planet under their rule. They killed millions, you know, in terms of their policies and their, you know, whether it was in India with famines or in Africa with their, you know, extraction, exploitation policies. I mean, these were not kind empires. The British was not a sweet empire. We just happened to have JP Morgan had lent, I don't know, hundreds of millions of dollars at the time. I mean, essentially billions of dollars in our current currency to the British and the French to fight the war. And we had to make sure that they didn't lose it. But fundamentally, I don't think that we should have been involved in that conflict. I think America, according to the tradition of the 19th century, going back to Washington, no entangling alliances, recognizing that Europe is full of various faction and we are not to be beholden to the British Empire. That was really our origin. And yet here we are since World War I, very much enmeshed with the British imperial policy. And the British imperial policy, you mentioned Russia, has been anti-Russian. Going back at least to the Crimea War, arguably before that, but the British policy was very much always to destabilize Russia because Russia was the great land power of Eurasia, you see, and because they called it the world island, you see. If Germany, Russia, and China ever got together economically, that's how many billions of people, that's wheat, that's natural resources, oil, everything that they need as far as to sustain themselves. And so the British policy actually since the turn of the 20th century was to keep those guys at odds, to keep the neighbors vying against each other, you know, to really distrust any major land powers so that they could use maritime trafficking, transport of goods. They've always been opposed to the idea of a new Silk Road, for example, you know, bringing rail traffic and goods across Eurasia from China. So what, again, I'm just contextualizing this anti-Russia thing that we've gotten so much in our blood since the beginning of the Cold War, but this is very much the British policy was always anti-Russia. The Americans, we don't have anything against Russia because we're actually very similar to Russia. Mass multicultural country. I mean, is Russia more autocratic than the US? Yes, historically it's true, more autocratic. But as far as the people, the intellect, the culture, the multiculturalism, the intelligence, I mean, it's very similar. It's land, you know, this land power. It's very similar to America. So this idea of us being so anti-Russian has very much been ingrained into us by a lot of, you know, dogma and a fear, you know, as we saw through our lifetime, you know, fear of the communists. And as your uncle understood, you know, we can't, you know, we have to negotiate with these as partners. And what I saw in the last decade, you know, the last decade really has been not treating Russia as a partner, really going back to the 1990s, you could say, when the Soviet Union collapsed and we kind of looked at Russia as this weakened power. Oh, Russia, we can do what we want. We can take all the NATO countries. And even George Kennan warned in 98, he said to Thomas Friedman in an interview, he said, what Clinton is doing is treating Russia as an enemy. He said, I don't understand why we're treating Russia as an enemy anymore. The Cold War is over. We don't need to treat Russia as an enemy, as an occupying, we don't need to be an occupying power here. We need to work to basically bring Russia into, you know, the Western sphere of economics, of you know, democracies, but not just to exploit them. And there was a lot of that that took place in the 90s, as far as, you know, Jeffrey Sachs and others going there with shock therapy, you know, a lot of looting that took place of Russian resources, of the ruble, you know, a lot of oligarchs basically being born from that time period. And Russia was a wrecked country. So what Putin did basically from 99 forward was restabilize Russia. Even though he's been an autocrat, he's been able to give Russia stability in a way that having governments every 4 years probably wouldn't have done. And that's not to say they don't have a parliament. They do have a parliament. They do have various political parties. They have opposition, but he stabilized it in a way that brought them back to prominence and power that didn't exist. And that's why what we saw in the last decade of American arrogance, to treat Russia with so much arrogance to say, we can bring NATO right up to your border. We can go into Georgia. No, and Putin said no in 2008. Remember, there was a brief war. He said no. And in 2008, he said, don't bring it into Ukraine. These are border countries. It's like Mexico and Canada would be for the United States. If Mexico made an alliance with China and stopped dealing with America, we'd have problems, right? So that was Russia's attitude. And rather than respecting Russia as a partner, as a great power would, saying, okay, Russia, you're a great power. That's your neighbor. Look, we don't need NATO there. Ukraine can be a buffer state, can trade with both sides, you know, can trade with the West. We don't need a Western-installed, Western-controlled government in there. But no, we didn't do that in 2014. And ever since then, there's been a war in the Donbas region against Russian separatists and, you know, a lot of Russian-speaking people in that region that are probably majority pro-Russian. So there's been problems ever since 2014. So we haven't respected Russia. And I think this is much more the Anglophile approach, the Anglo-imperial model of basically try to keep Russia unsettled, try to keep, you know, have conflict around Russia as much as possible, as opposed to the American, the peace faction, the American, you know, the Kennedy version, which is, hey, let's talk to them. Let's negotiate with them as a great power. Let's treat them as a great power. Let's respect them. And if there's mutual respect, I think we can get a lot further.
How do you explain the fact that Russia has, under Putin, been completely incapacitated economically, that the only exports, there is nothing that you buy in this country, almost any other nation in the world, that says made in Russia? And how come with this population that's extraordinarily brilliant, particularly in the engineering and mathematics and physics, a country that is the largest country in the world, that has the greatest landmass, that has this abundance of resources, how come the only exports that they have are oil and gas and, you know, minerals? It's a third world country. And why?
Well, the thing, I think
not able to industrialize and to make
wheat. don't forget about wheat, grain and wheat. I mean, they do export grain and wheat. You know, it's difficult to say because a lot of our models of economics are based on this idea of export, right? America doesn't export anything. What do we export? We export dollars. we sell people dollars because they need dollars to buy oil. So it's like America is a great export country. I mean, obviously our economy is built around obviously consumerism, but we have technologies, we have, you name it, right? Internet, IT, we build things, culture, entrepreneurship.
And we have culture too.
We have culture. Yeah.
We have TV.
Yeah. We have influence. Exactly.
We have our final readout because we used to have electronics. We used to make stereos and television sets and automobiles in the world. We still make automobiles for export.
A little, yeah. I mean, I don't know what the deal is. I know under Trump, there was sort of a little bit of a resurgence. But listen, I remember hearing that Moscow was ranked in one of the top megacities in the world just this past year or in the last couple of years. It's been ranked in the top 10 cities. So obviously Russia's doing something right. It's not a backwater is the point. You know, I've been there to Moscow. I've been there to Kazan in the east. I haven't been to St. Petersburg yet, but just again, like seeing, you know, they have, there is money. I felt when I was in Moscow, I felt closer to being like in a Paris or something as far as the culture, the attitude, the economy was concerned. The texture of the city. So it didn't feel like these are impoverished people, right? So I'm not an analyst. I don't know exactly what their economy is based on. I'm not that familiar with Russia, but I do know that these people weren't starving. And you talk to Russians, they're like, the 90s, we were starving. The 90s, we were waiting in line to get bread and food. We couldn't, you know, we had nothing. And now it seemed closer to what you would consider like a modern Western or Central European city than not.
What would your solution in the Ukraine be at this point?
Gosh, I mean, how would I negotiate the Ukraine situation? I would honor that I would basically push Zelensky. I would not be sending him weaponry. I mean, this is exactly like, this is all you're doing is fomenting more casualties, you know, more civilian casualties. I would say, listen, you know, first of all, let's understand clearly what Putin's demands are. If we're talking about denazification, Azov battalion, various neo-Nazi battalions that Facebook all of a sudden says, okay, those Nazis are okay, right? Historically, we don't like Nazis, but these Nazis are okay. No, there are real neo-Nazi battalions that have been incorporated into the government and into the national forces. Look at that seriously. And again, you have these neo-Nazis that are very anti-Russian. They, remember, Hitler saw the Russians as Slavs. He said, they're Slavs, they're a lower class. It wasn't just Jews that this master race philosophy. And this is what people forgot when they haven't studied Nazism. Nazism was about the idea of the master race and then the various sub-races, including Jews, including Blacks, including Slavs. And that's what, there are these neo-Nazis that are, you know, obviously I'm mentioning the Azov Battalion and other groups, that ideology, because remember, a lot of these guys are our ancestors, their parents were involved in joining the Nazis during the World War. You know, a lot of these Ukrainians joined the Nazi party. There was Stefan Bandera, who has become a national hero, who was a Ukrainian Nazi. I mean, targeting Poles and Russians and Jews. It's remarkable that this is so blatant in aspects of modern Ukrainian ultra-nationalism. And yet people are just in denial about it because they are so anti-Russian in their own regards, in their own psychology of being, again, caught in this Cold War mentality that Russia is the bad guy, Russia is the boogeyman, Russia is here to take over the world, which really, I mean, as my father did in his Untold History, pointed out what Russia did, even as expansive as they were at the end of the Second World War, Stalin never really broke his treaty with Churchill. As far as the countries that they agreed upon, Churchill and he agreed upon carving up, because Churchill was, well, he's an imperialist. The British had an empire. As I mentioned, a quarter of the world was under their control. You know, America was an empire. We had Spanish Philippines. Thankfully, Roosevelt was an anti-imperialist. So we started that policy of getting rid of this empire. But the British weren't interested in getting rid of empire. So they were interested in cutting a deal with the Soviets. You get Eastern Europe, a little bit of Central Europe. We get influence in Greece and Turkey and all these other countries. And this was pure balance of power, empire.
Actually, Stalin turned against Molotov and some of his other top aides when they tried to ferment or support the communist movement in Greece because Stalin said that. And by the way, Stalin is one of the maybe three worst people in human history. Before Hitler, he was the greatest mass murderer. He starved to death. Deliberately, purposefully, 3 million people in the Ukraine, and another million people were shot or gassed after that. You know, as you point out, it's a very complex history. Stalin and Hitler divided the Ukraine into two parts, divided by the Ribbentrop-Molotov line. And Hitler essentially killed everybody who was not could not live with the Nazi paradigm on the western side of that line, and Stalin killed everybody who was an ethnic Russian on the east side of that line. And we're living now with the legacies of those divergent ideologies, ethnicities, and attitudes. And it's part of the complexity that, you know, I think that we should talk about. I don't know what we should do in the Ukraine, but I know that it offends me that we're being carried by this wave of propaganda with very, very little understanding of, you know, what the historical antecedents are. And also, the Joint Chiefs and the CIA almost brought the world to war in 1962. Because the Russians, in retaliation for us putting missiles, Jupiter missiles in Turkey, the Russians had put missiles in Cuba, which was 1,100 miles from Washington. And we said, you can't do that. We'll go to war with you if you try to do that. And now we've got military installations now in countries which were former Soviet satellites that we promised when Gorbachev broke up the Soviet Union, we promised we would not move NATO one inch to the east. And we broke that promise. And, you know, Putin said, but you better not go into the Ukraine. And we need to recognize some of the historical antecedents of this conflict and not just submit to this easy propaganda trope that Putin is like Hitler, Putin is like Saddam Hussein, he's evil, he's bad, we need to destroy him. We need to maybe undo what President Kennedy did with Khrushchev and say, well, I got to put myself in his shoes. And we need to do a little of that as a nation. We need to debate it.
Right. Totally agree. By the way, just you mentioned the Molotov-Ribbentrop, but that was Poland, not Ukraine. Ukraine was occupied by Nazis, and that's where a lot of the alliances came from. You know, it was in certain, you know, Ukrainians joining the Nazis during that time period. Yeah, I mean, we're basically, you know,
Stalin and Hitler divided up the Ukraine too. I mean, they controlled different parts of the Ukraine during different parts of the war.
It wasn't an agreement. It was when the Nazis were invading Russia. That's when they got into the Ukraine. It was in that time period, because remember, Ukraine was historically Russia. It's historically Russia. It's also been historically part of sort of the greater Polish or Lithuanian empires and Austro-Hungarian empire. I mean, it's really changed hands, but there is the Eastern has been traditionally more Russian speaking, more Slavic in the East, which has been a lot of influence from the Western and the Anglo country. I'm sorry, the Angles, like the Northern Angles in the Saxons and whatnot. So that's why you end up, I think, in some ways with some of the Ukrainians going with the Germans during the Second World War under the occupation. But no, it wasn't a formal agreement in that sense. That was already once Hitler, they did divide Poland, but this was after Hitler invaded East, right? And he was moving East. That's when he took Ukraine. Well, the point is, Ukraine is a multicultural country. And I think that's something that we have, that even Ukrainians are struggling with, as people will see in the Ukraine on Fire and the Revealing Ukraine, the sequel that my father made, where you see this post-2014 ultra-nationalism resurgent in Ukraine, basically being so anti-Russian. And yet, again, a lot of their, it's like, it would be like if, you know, if we had a government that was basically anti-Mexican and basically starting to foment an anti-Mexican sentiment across the country, right? And let's say this was exacerbated, obviously, because the fighting started. There were separatists in the East that yes, they were supported by Putin, but they were also, you know, Ukrainians who were Russian and said, listen, we want to be separate from this ultranationalism that we see resurgent that seems to be anti-Russian in the West. And there's been a war ever since then, 60,000 casualties, let's not forget. So people are crying here over the Ukraine. It's like, well, where were your tears for the last 8 years? A lot of people didn't even know about this. And I think this is the point of propaganda, how much it's really what the media tells us. And we can't discount the fact here too, that as you know, the moment that our country, which has been in literally in a tyrannical fashion, forcing people to take an experimental injection, forcing people to wear masks, forcing children to wear masks for eight plus hours a day, depriving them of their very basic right to oxygen. Our country that so hates freedom, if you stand up for freedom and they say you're a white supremacist for standing up for the freedom against masks or injections, at the moment that they drop mandates, they turned around and said, now fight for the freedom of Ukraine. Americans need to stand up for the freedom of Ukraine. Can we not see the propaganda that's at work here? We can't stand up for our own freedoms, but we have to stand up for Ukrainian freedoms. And have you ever seen in your lifetime every major corporation saying, I stand with Yemen, I stand with Libya, I stand with Iraq? Of course not. We didn't stand with any of these countries when they were being bombed, or, you know, the people when they were being bombed. I ask people all the time, you're crying for the Ukrainians that have been killed, which is a tragedy. Anywhere civilians are killed in every war, but you're talking maybe a handful, a few thousand. How many people have been killed in Yemen in the bombings of the last few years? Almost 500,000. And again, 60,000 casualties in Ukraine before this invasion from Russia. Were you crying for them then? This is my point about propaganda and how the media knows, and the narrative makers in Washington and the policy creators and the Council on Foreign Relations and their offshoot, you know, the various think tanks and foundations that are influencing a lot of what we see, right? What's propagated. And obviously it is for a military industrial complex that is tied to Wall Street, that is tied to all the major international corporations, right? There is an agenda at work. And so that's why I mentioned, you know, the first Iraq war. It's like starting to realize the dispelling of my own illusion. My God, America's not the good guy in the world. You know, I think in our constitution, we're the good guy. I think that we have a beautiful principle, but do our policymakers represent that? Do the Bidens and the Pelosis and the Bushes and the Cheneys and the Clintons and the people that have been literally in power for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, are they not autocrats, political autocrats, just like Putin? Oh, they get elected. They just get elected every time. Is that it? They're just so wonderful at how they run things. We just keep putting them back in office. Well, then that tells us we really have to ask ourselves what we're doing, what we're thinking. We're stuck with such rotten representatives.
How does globalization and transhumanism fit into this picture?
it's ultimately about control.
Just give us a definition of globalization.
Globalization is, I think, you know, it's an arguable definition. I think that we've been globalized since the days of Alexander the Great, you know, since the days of the Persian Empire, right? The idea of bringing peoples together across the planet through trade, through nations like the Persian Empire, which accepted different religions and accepted, you know, different ethnicities into a multicultural empire. That Alexander, very similar, the Roman Empire, obviously more based in conquest. I mean, they're all based in conquest, right? But the point is that these empires, they're trying to control as much of the world as possible. What happened at the end of the 19th century is that the British Empire, which at that time was really the greatest power the world had ever seen, with, as I mentioned, a quarter of the world's population or landmass, a quarter of the world's landmass under its control, and markets and controlling the sea lanes and the shipping, right, and the traffic and the banking. The British Empire realized that they came to their Vietnam crisis during the Boer War, and they realized we don't have the martial power to enforce it. I mean, even in India, they had been using things like the British East India Company and mercenary armies and things like this. But during the Boer War, they realized, even, you know, just fighting these Dutch settlers and trying to get control of the mines, you know, the gold and diamonds, right? This is the great, the Beers, and, you know, everyone's heard of the Beers, and all this started with blood. It started with slavery. It started with concentration camps. This came out of the Boer War. And the British experience was, wow, we can't police this empire. We have to make it an ideological empire. We have to bring, this is where the Rhodes Scholarship came derived from this, because Cecil Rhodes, who was the founder of De Beers and other things, he basically was saying, we need to bring America back into our fold. We have to bring America back into the empire, but it has to be an empire more of mind and law, legal structures and things like this, right? So what is the modern, you know, what is the modern New World Order was transitioning away from the idea of the British Empire to a more Commonwealth structure based in laws, contracts, agreements, and international powers superseding nation states. So then you ultimately get, after World War II, you get what? The IMF and the World Bank and all these, you know, and these sort of these international bodies that are basically there presumably to lend money, but oftentimes in predatory fashion, as we've seen. I mean, John Perkins is a great book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, about how, you know, how countries would be manipulated by IMF policies and CIA, obviously oftentimes getting in there, sometimes assassinating leaders who get in the way. But again, moving these countries into more globalized structures, right? To the place where the idea is to take away power. So why do you, people ask me all the time, how is it possible to control it so readily? Well, that's the question. How is it that all these governments are following lockstep with the same policies pretty much dictated by the WHO, or, you know, maybe like, you know, CDC and whatnot, but, you know, why is it they're all following the same orders, essentially, not across the board. Obviously, there are countries that, as you know, issued ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine and made that available. But for the most part, there's been a lockstep of response, right, to how we're going to deal with this. We're going to lock down. We're going to force masks. You know, we're basically going to keep you six feet apart. We're not really going to treat this as far as, you know, the ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine or other things that are available to treat it. We're not really going to treat it. We're just going to respond. But how is that possible unless you have international globalist structures in place to essentially mandate it? And coming, you know, a mixture from the private sector, the foundations, the Gates Foundations and others that are helping to sponsor the education process, right, for this movement. But essentially, it is a more of a globalized response, which always already indicates global systems of power. And oftentimes we've heard some presidents, for example, in Tanzania, I remember, and others who are questioning this, the CPR testing, right, and questioning the PCR testing, saying this doesn't seem legitimate because I PCR tested a fruit and a goat and they both tested positive for coronavirus. And what happened to him? He died. And the other presidents seem to indicate that they were actually being bribed, again, by international structures, saying we were offered millions of dollars in loans, right, or money for our country if we followed these measures. So that's what that's why I say, like, globalization has this great dark side. There's the beautiful side of connection, being able to meet our counterparts across the planet, to trading goods. But the dark side is these conglomerate international corporations, as we know, that are getting more and more powerful, wealthier and wealthier. They have no allegiance to America or to the country that they started in, right? Because they're offshore and their finances are international, and they don't really pay taxes in their country. And so that's really the dark side of what we're seeing, is these global controls tied very much between government, big corporations, big foundations, and how they're able to dictate from beyond our constitutional promise, which is that those powers, those rights, those things we don't enumerate for the federal government are supposed to be reserved to we the people, and they're not.
Yeah, in my book, I talk about a slew of deaths among young African presidents, all of whom had opposed the WHO imposition. I don't say they were murdered, but it is peculiar that all the people, that all, virtually all the African presidents who resisted WHO died suddenly and inexplicably. Talk about how transhumanism, this kind of ideology of transhumanism that is now so popular in Silicon Valley and, you know, and with the World Economic Forum, that it's actually getting traction as, you know, as something that has a beneficial outcome for humanity.
Right, exactly. Well, as Klaus Schwab, I think, explained it the best, he said that it will be possible to merge your physical, your digital, and your biological identity. That's the phrase, to merge them. What is transhumanism by that? Essentially, to merge technology that we are using currently outside of ourselves, right? In the various forms of apps and you name it, the computers, things like this, merging that more and more into the physical body, into whether it's a Neuralink, almost like a Bluetooth interaction between yourself and the technology that you can operate telepathically, right? But essentially this process of merging the technology into our physical forms, they call it, you know, transcending what it is to be a biological human, to start gene editing and things like this, which,
as if this is a good thing.
Yes, that's their perspective. It's also about controlling the population. It's literally about how do we organize this mass of people. And that's why some of these agendas talked about, I think, Agenda 21 and things like this, the UN Agenda 21 is all about putting people into smarter and smarter cities, right? So that they can be more ordered and controlled within a grid, and rather than having this disorderly population that's, you know, maybe rural, that's maybe in small towns and scattered across a large population. If they can gather the population into smart cities where everything is, as we know, more easily monitored, surveilled, you know, the energy expenditure, everything can be monitored and controlled more readily, then they look at it as being more conducive to their agenda, which is ultimately what, to, as one theory, you know, that they would like us to basically to control our patterns of behavior, our patterns of consumption, right? If you think about it from the elite perspective, you want to, you know, if you're making money on people, well, you want to continue to make money on people. So you want to control their, what they consume, right? And how much they consume of it, that kind of thing. There's an argument that's actually, if you are an elite and you really believe, and this is, you know, this is the argument I get into sometimes with some of them, is like, there's this belief that they know better, that they basically really believe, you know, we've made money, or we come from bloodlines that have made money, and, you know, we've gone to good schools, and we've, you know, we know what needs to be done for the future of humanity, and we're here to decide it for you, which is very antithetical to certainly the American principle, you know, the constitutional principle of no, God gives each of us a spirit and a life, and we really are, you know, not pure individuals, but we're here basically with an individual spirit. And we're here as entrepreneurs, and we, you know, this middle class American dream ethos that's come with it is to say, no, we actually can figure things out for ourselves, and we can actually create alternative systems if you allow free markets to exist. But the elites, as much as they say free market economics, I don't believe for a second that they actually believe in free market economics. I think that they hide behind that. Corporate socialism is one of the greatest things we've seen throughout our whole life, right? Is how much money these major corporations, in fact, in my Paradigm of Money documentary, I interviewed this guy who represents small and medium businesses. He says, you don't realize how much money that's earmarked for small businesses actually goes to big corporations. It's insane how much there's corporate welfare that goes on, and just the nature of our, you know, of our globalist structures is more conducive to the global corporation. Because if you can have your supply chain in India, right, you can pay people half or a third of the price you'd pay someone in America. It's great for the corporate bottom line, but how does it affect real wages in America? They haven't grown since the 70s, as far as I've checked. Last I checked, real wages haven't gone up because we're not making comparable, you know, what used to be good blue collar union type of wages in America. I remember this all through the 2000s when I was in college, and I was sitting there going, reading the newspaper. We just lost 30,000 jobs in Detroit, but we got 50,000 new service sector jobs. I go, great. So you were paying someone $30 an hour. Now you pay them $10 an hour. How is that helping that person? That's great for your corporate bottom line, for Wall Street and the speculators, right? If you're invested in that company, I'm sure you're doing well, but how is it helping me to, you know, to lose a job that was paying me good wages so I can get another job in the service sector that's paying me a third of the price, so that you can go pay, you know, because you're a big corporation, you can go pay someone in Vietnam or China to do it for, you know, again, a third or a quarter of the price, so you make all the profit. That's what's been really going on. You know, I did my Best Kept Secret docuseries about the sociopathic nature of many of our elites and how they operate and how they their worldview and how much they are willing to manipulate and control. I mean, look, MKUltra was a government-sponsored mind control program, but it used who? It used doctors and scientists and big foundations in the private sector to do this horrible treatment of humans.
Universities. I mean, huge university.
Yeah, exactly.
Receiving millions from the CIA.
Yeah, and so we can't kid ourselves that just because someone's in a white lab coat, they're a good guy. I mean, no, there are plenty of sociopaths in all spectrums, and especially at the top levels, as we all know, that don't have compassion of, you know, for humanity. They're looking at humans as this sort of this thing, this virus, even as they said in the Matrix, you know, we're a virus to a lot of them, and we need to be moved around, pricked, prodded, sometimes killed, imprisoned. I mean, it's like there's a sociopathology to a lot of the rulership. And just Gates, I mean, for example, why did this guy befriend Epstein? Is, you know, people have to ask themselves that, you know, what would bring him to Epstein's door? Bill Gates, one of the richest men in the world, is not looking for money from Jeffrey Epstein. Let's not kid ourselves. Epstein was also very fascinated by a lot of these concepts of transhumanism, the idea of the power of the genes, you know, and how he, again, we talked a little briefly about this idea of genetic modification. Eugenics didn't come from Germany. Eugenics came from here. There's a great book by Black about Edwin Black, War Against the Weak, I think it's called. And it's about how the first eugenics conferences took place here. They were sponsored by the various Anglo-American factions in Britain as well. There were a lot of very elite people that were interested in eugenics and the idea of breeding and good breeding, right? So Nazism didn't evolve its eugenics concept out of whole cloth. A lot of it was derived. And at the end of the war, they realized eugenics is a bad word. Let's call it, you know, genetic research, genetic modification, right? Genetic modification of crops. And guess what? They're bringing it to humanity. I don't see why people think that's so far-fetched when we have no problem genetically modifying the crops we eat, or potentially genetically modifying the animals that we're raising to eat. And, you know, why is it a far stretch of the imagination to genetically modify humans? But what is that going to create? You know, there's a lot of elites that are very happy to genetically modify their kids, like Gattaca. You know, I want to create a perfect child. I want them to be, someone told me the other day, I want to genetically modify my children to be as tall and as smart and good looking as possible. I'm like, you don't know what you're doing, though. I mean, you think that's perfected. You don't know the cause and consequence, because again, life is more, as there are great, you know, biologists like Bruce Lipton and others talk about this, life is more than just the blueprints that you're given. It's obviously, you know, there's so many other factors that go into it. It's environmental, right? It's you could say spiritual, it's emotional. And what are the consequences you're going to create, diseases you're going to create as a result of this manipulation of biology? We don't even know. It's like Dr. Frankenstein. We don't know what's going to happen here, but we're at the cusp of something really huge happening. And, you know, I brought that up because of Epstein was interested in these things, and maybe that's where he and Gates were connected. I don't know.
Where can our listeners follow you or find you?
Yeah, honestly, I think the best place is seanstone.info, my website, because it links to really all my my documentaries, my channels, my book. It's really easier for people to go to seanstone.info.
Seanstone, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I hope that we can get you back, as I think we just scratched the surface of your knowledge about these extraordinary knowledge about the issues that are more important to us today than probably at any time in history, and more important than any other issue right now for Americans to understand, as to understand what the enemy is.
Yes,
to be
exactly.
Armed.
Yes, they're close.
Resist the propaganda.
Exactly. The enemy is closer to home, and that's the point. We have to recognize them at home. Otherwise, we are just waste their energy with looking abroad. We have to start here.
Thank you, Sean.
It's a pleasure.
Really?
Yeah, we didn't even get to plastic pollution.
We'll get there next time. Thank you, Sean.